He held on to the child as long as he could, and he could feel his ears starting to burst.
Was anyone at all thinking there was any possibility that this child is alive?
So he could determine whether or not this was an accident.
Right.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in the studio is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. Jim and I are in the studio together, along with our special guest. Right, Jim? It's nice to actually be all together.
That's right. And with us today is...
Hi, I'm Bobby Chacon. I'm a 27-year FBI agent, and during the course of my career... I established and built the FBI's underwater forensic program.
Well, hopefully, Bobby, we'll get to talk a little bit about that today.
Yes, hopefully.
Well, it's great to have you again.
Thanks.
And our listeners might remember Bobby from our live podcast at CrimeCon last year. Hopefully, he'll join us at CrimeCon again this year.
Oh, that's the plan.
All right. Excellent.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming, Bobby. So let's dive right into it.
Okay.
Excuse the pun. So what were you doing when this case that you're going to talk to us about today came in?
Interestingly enough, I was down in Miami with several other of the FBI dive teams, and we were keeping safe the shoreline of Biscayne Bay, where a large nuclear scientist/government official conference was taking place, and they traveled from all over the world to this thing in Miami, and it was government officials and scientists. And so it had a lot of security because of the people that were involved in it. And the hotel conference center was on the water. And so we would search the piers and the pilings every evening and every morning, because they would have cocktail receptions out there and things like that. So that was one of the other jobs that the FBI dive program had, because we had the assets to be both on the water and under the water and to do searches. So if anybody was going to try to plant a device, say, under one of these decks that they were going to have a big reception for that evening, we would hopefully put a stop to that. So that's where I was when we got a call from South Carolina, that they needed us to deploy back up there, because the sheriff's department up there, who we had trained previously with on some dive matters, had a case up there that they needed our help on.
Great.
Yeah. Well, so tell our listeners where this was in your career. You're obviously on this dive team, FBI's dive team. When this case came in, how long had you been on the dive team that you created?
I came into the FBI in 1987. I came on the dive team in New York office in 1995. And this particular case happened in 2007. I had become the dive team leader in New York in 1999. And then I left New York. I transferred to Los Angeles division of the FBI in 2003. So this was 4 years after getting to Los Angeles. But 2004, I was in Athens, Greece for the Olympics for a year. Then I went to Iraq for the year of 2005, and then again in 2006. So 2007, I kind of landed back in LA, even though I had been assigned there since 2003. I landed back there and got into the dive team, you know, on a more full-time basis.
So you're in Miami. You obviously have, you and your team have a lot of experience at this point, and you get a call from a sheriff in South Carolina. Now, right. As our listeners will know, South Carolina does have some coastline, but I'm assuming that the FBI dive team does more than work in the open water.
Yeah, and this was a lake case. So down in Biscayne Bay where we were working, that was obviously salt water. It was the intercoastal waterway. And, you know, that was, I think we were 3 days into a 5-day conference, and our program managers in Quantico said, you know, divert some resources from the Miami thing, because you've got Miami-Dade Police, you've got the sheriff's office down there. So we had a lot of dive assets, and we could probably dispatch some up there. So I took a team from Miami then up to South Carolina to lend our assistance to this particular case. Now, when we got there, it was different than a lot of our cases, because this wasn't a case that involved alleged or believed criminal activity. This was a father that was on the lake with his three-year-old son, and he was out sailing. This is a father of, I'll keep the names generic, but I think he had five sons, and his wife was pregnant with number six, and he was out sailing with the three-year-old, and they were across a long, very large lake when a storm rolled in. The father was a former Navy guy, so he knew his way around the water, but the storm overtook them. The boat capsized. The three-year-old got caught up in the rigging of the boat underneath. The father went down to dive to try to free him, and the boat started to sink. And it was one of those small two-person boats. Like, if you look at the hull of these things, they almost look like a rocket. Very pointy in the front, very pointy in the back. So very hydrodynamic, which is what you want to move through the water. But it also means when it's moving down in the water, it's going to go fast. And so he couldn't free his child from that. He held on to the child in the rigging as the boat started to sink, and it started to sink with an acceleration. So it started going faster and faster as it sank in the water. He held on to the child as long as he could, and he could feel his ears starting to burst. And his description to us was, you know, he held on as long as he could, and then he thought he was about to die. And he released the grip on the child, and he watched the child disappear into the darkness of the bottom of the lake.
Oh, Bobby, this sounds horrific. There's just so many things I want to ask about just in your description. But I want to go back first to what you said about your call was not that it was a criminal case. And I'm interested that, and I'm sure our listeners are, that the FBI responds when there may very well be no criminal conduct.
Sure. I mean, the FBI has a big section at headquarters and a budget for what we call domestic police cooperation in this kind of case. We also have foreign police cooperation matters. But this is a request from a local police department for help or local sheriff's office for help. And if we have the resources and the assets that they need, it's quite often we go. And in the dive team, we often did that. For example, we responded to the space shuttle crash in 2003 because a large part of that was over water. And, there was not much criminal alleged activity that brought down the space shuttle, but we would go anyway because we're an asset of the federal government. NASA is a federal agency. They asked for our help, so we went. So quite often we are called upon to provide assistance to state and local jurisdictions. Actually, the FBI has a budget and a structure at headquarters that actually supplies that kind of help. If we have assets or particular expertise that are needed, it doesn't necessarily have to be a criminal matter, or it can be just a purely state criminal matter that we have no jurisdiction in that we lend assistance to. And so in this case, they knew about us because we had trained them on some underwater post-blast courses. So they knew that we had certain tools at our disposal that they didn't have. So when this child went missing, they knew what they needed to do to conduct the underwater search. They knew they didn't have their tools available. They knew we did. So they just called us.
Well, it brings up a lot of questions, but I think I'm going to hold them till you get a little more into the story, because already I can't help but be somewhat suspicious about this story. I don't mean to impugn this father, and I certainly hope it turns out that it was just a horrible accident, but I can't help but be a little suspicious. So set the scene a little bit for our listeners. You and how many people are on your team that you've taken from Miami? You land in South Carolina. What kind of equipment do you have, and what do you do?
Okay, so normally the process was for myself or one of my divers to fly ahead and do a site survey and kind of gauge how much we would need, what the needs would be for the dive. But I got all that information from the dive team leader that called me or called us for the assistance. So I talked to him at length from Miami, and I knew what we needed. We didn't need as much dive assets because they had divers to do that, but they needed the technical expertise. So we had some sonar and some underwater vehicles that they didn't have. So the technology that they needed for us to deploy was stuff that just they didn't have in their arsenal. They did have divers. So I deployed with five divers and myself. I took five guys that were very technically savvy. Two of them were the guys who instruct others in some of this equipment and stuff. So, and the other three had just been through some of the training courses for some of this equipment. And so I deployed with five divers and myself, and the Miami team and the New York team stayed in Miami conducting, you know, the sweeps of the pier.
So it sounds like, though, that the way you've already described it, that this is going to be a pretty deep dive.
Yes.
And that means it's probably really cold down there, right?
Mm-hmm,
and
dark.
You're going to have to deal with the same pressures that almost killed the father, right?
Sure. And more so, in fact, because This was a man-made lake, and often in man-made lakes, what happens is, and we've come across this a lot, either the Army Corps of Engineers or whatever authority gets the land by eminent domain or whatever, however they do it, they form a valley, and they're supposed to clear-cut everything. So all of the trees and stuff are supposed to be cut down at ground level and taken off and the timber. If you don't do that, you have these long, large, tall, underwater standing trees, which nobody would care about unless you have to work on the bottom. In this case, what they did was they clear cut about 30 feet from the shoreline down, thinking no one would ever care or notice. The contractor probably got away with something because he was supposed to do a lot more work than he actually did. So then they flood the valley and it becomes a lake. But those trees are still there. And for a diver, that's a death trap because the trees and the branches and everything. So when you go down there, it's very, very easy to get stuck.
Well, and it's pitch black,
it's
right?
It's pitch black. And it's just an entanglement hazard that could easily kill a diver.
My home in Virginia, it's actually on a man-made lake like that. And they did clear cut about 800 acres of trees, but they also basically wired down, cabled down piles of these trees for fish habitats. So they made them all over the lake. You know, in the deep parts of the lake, they literally just kind of bolted them down to stumps that they cut down. And so, I mean, there are hazards in it, but most of it is clear.
Right. Yeah, that's my new favorite phrase. Bobby's just taught me, entanglement hazard.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
So, you know, the first thing we did was put a boat towed sonar in the water. And we kind of started at the outskirts of the lake, and right away on our first couple of passes, you could see a clear line. You see a clear bottom, and then this basically black wall, which what is a wall of trees. Sonar only gives you shadows, so, you know, acoustic sounds. So the acoustic sounds off of these things, so you see the trees, but you really see this mass because it was just a thick forest of trees with branches sticking out. But it was pretty clear. We had a clear line delineated. So when they did cut it, there was a clear line. Unfortunately, where the father pinpointed where he was when the boat went down was inside the forested line. So the boat is in those trees.
So you know now your job is going to be even more complicated. So can you tell our listeners how does this happen? I mean, is everyone sitting on the shore? Do you have boats out? What are you doing when you're running that sonar to try to figure out literally the picture of what you have underneath? And I know I'm asking multiple questions. Jim always gets annoyed with me when I do this. Most importantly, was anyone at all thinking there was any possibility that this child is alive?
No. By the time we got there, it was 2 to 3 days in. And so what we walked into usually was a community that's devastated, that's been out there not knowing what to do, and everyone's waiting for somebody to come in and do something. And so when we come in, they're usually looking at us, staring at us, waiting for us to do something. And it's a devastated community. The family obviously was there. I tried to keep my divers away from that particular emotional dynamic because I needed them to focus on the work.
Of course.
And so, but I met with the lead detective and the dive team leader of that county, and they introduced me to the father, and we spoke. And the mother and the 4 or 5 siblings all would set up lawn chairs right at the boat ramp.
Oh, wow.
And the father, and they would all have lunch, and the local newspaper would be there, and they'd see us go out every morning, and we'd get on the boat, and we'd go out, and we'd what we call mow the lawn, which is the way you drag the sonar back and forth, very similar to if you were mowing a lawn. You try to overlap so you don't miss anything. And we were starting to see, you know, this big wall of trees, and we just couldn't penetrate it with our sonar because it was just giving us too much return, because every little piece gives a return. And so we tried to work with the father in pinpointing where the boat went down. The other thing that the sheriff kind of whispered to us was that a lot of people on that lake, what they do is for extra storage in these boats, because they're tiny kind of boats, they carve out a piece of the front and they put like a cooler in there or something. And what that does is it takes a lot of the flotation away from the boat because you're carving out foam. That foam is what makes the boat float. So the boat's much less seaworthy if you do that. And apparently that was the case here. Also, that they continually tell the parents that do recreational sailing on this lake, do not tie your children to the boat. And most of the parents were doing that. They would tie the children to the boat in case they fell in the water, they could pull the child back.
Tie their children to the boat.
Right. They'd be tethered to the boat.
That's crazy. I mean, I grew up not, you know, I didn't grow up a ton on boats, but my family and we had lots of friends who had boats and we would go boating on the biggest lake system in the Atlantic area. It's called Lake Lanier. It's huge. And I don't remember ever seeing people being tied to boats. This just sounds dangerous.
Well, I mean, it's almost like a safety belt, I suppose. But
Yeah, the only ones I know that do it are the open ocean, the big sailing, because those boats get up on an angle and those guys lean way back. They have these rails that they're tethered into, they're carabinered in, because those boats are going very, very fast. You fall off, you could die. I mean, those are moving like a race car would move.
Well, it just seems like the problem is solved by wearing a life vest.
Right.
Well, I'm sure a life vest is one way, but I would hope that the kids were wearing life vests and they were sort of leashed to the boat so that if they fell over, they could be pulled back in. I mean, especially on a very small boat. Is this a huge lake? I mean,
It was a big lake. It was deep.
But what's the water like? I mean, the Great Lakes, there are waves.
Yeah, those are like oceans. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the freighters on there.
Right.
Yeah.
But is this a situation where it would typically get so choppy and stormy that it was a likelihood that a kid would fall off of a boat?
Yeah, I don't know that particular aspect of it. I just know that there were signs up and they would tell the parents each season, don't tie your children to the boats. They put them in a life jacket, but don't tie them to the boats, because if the boat sinks, the kid goes with it, whether he's wearing a life jacket or not.
And so while you were talking to the lead detective and the other divers there, did they tell you whether or not the father had said the child was tied to the boat?
Yeah, the father said the child wasn't. The police indicated to me that they probably didn't believe him.
Have you ever wondered how someone can just disappear, leaving no trace behind? I'm Marissa, and I'm the host of The Vanished, which is a podcast dedicated to spreading awareness about missing persons cases. In each episode, I share these stories with the help of the loved ones who are still looking for answers. In episodes 114 and 115, I covered the disappearance of 7-month-old Christopher Abeda, who was kidnapped from his crib on July 15, 1986. You'll get to hear from his older sister Denise, who was just 15 years old at the time. She has vivid memories of Christopher in the hours leading up to his disappearance.
We were all sitting around the living room, and Christopher had taken literally his first steps around the coffee table.
The next morning, she awoke to find her mom frantically searching the house for baby Christopher.
I remember my mom, I heard her voice before I saw her, but I heard her say, "Where's Christopher? Christopher, he's not here. Where's Christopher?" And then she pushed open my door. My mom goes down the stairs and she literally falls down the stairs.
Christopher's mom was diagnosed with terminal cancer in 2016 and passed away last year without ever knowing what happened to her baby. She'd never given up looking, and now Denise is carrying on the fight.
Knowing what my mom did for 32 years, I will not let her time go to waste.
Find The Vanished on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, thevanishedpodcast.com, or anywhere that you listen to podcasts.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
So let's go to the next step. What happened next? You got there, you got the sonar running, you realize that this boat is most likely behind this line of trees. How do you deal with that? What's going on?
So it's painstaking, it's slow and it's methodical. So we would review the images that we got every day on the sonar. We'd review them at night. So it was really this is a 20 hours a day proposition. So we would look at our sonar imaging and look for opportunities to penetrate this wall of trees. Now, we wouldn't penetrate it with divers, although one of the reasons the sheriff called us up is they knew one or two of their divers did get stuck. Luckily, they got freed when they first started searching. The FBI team at the time, and still do, now many, some other local teams do, but we dive on surface applied air. So we go down on an umbilical. So if I drop a diver into those trees and he gets stuck, I could feed him air for a week.
Until we can get
something else down there to clear him. If you're on scuba and you're not tied to the surface with a hose so that you can breathe through, which we are, you've got about 30 minutes, 40 minutes of life left. And if you're struggling, it's going to be even less. Right. So it's a really dangerous proposition. So we could have done both, but I didn't want to put my divers in that position anyway, even with surface applied air, because you could still die in that kind of environment because your hose could get caught and get tangled and get ripped. So what we did was we found a couple of kind of inroads that we thought we might be able to get in. One of our
trails into the trees.
Trails through the trees. But that took getting the sonar in a lot of different positions. So it took a while to get. So we're talking about several days of data. And then we would put what we call a ROV, a remote operated vehicle, which is a robot. It's a robot. We have several different sizes of them. Some as small as a milk crate kind of thing. And then some as large as a business desk. And it all depends on where you're using it, a lake as opposed to the open ocean, stuff like that. So those things have a camera. They have lights. Front and rear camera. They have an arm, a manipulator arm that we can outfit with different things, a grabber, a cutter, whatever we need to do. So we dropped our remote operated vehicle at several different spots, and then we dropped it outside the tree line, and then we let it go into the tree line. Now, again, since it's a tethered vehicle, just like a tethered diver, you're dragging an umbilical behind you. It increases the chance of getting tangled up. So it's very difficult. So a lot of times what we call the pilot who's driving that ROV, flying that ROV underwater, would have to kind of get it in there, look around, and come back out. And sometimes they got stuck. And, you know, if we could drop the diver down the umbilical and pull on the vehicle and get it out and then put it into another place. So this went on for probably 3 or 4 days. And each day, we come back, we're taking our gear out, we're washing it down, they're doing their diagnostics because you have to fix the gear every day. So the mother and the father and the four other children, and remember the mother's pregnant, are waiting for us as we get to the shore. And the sheriff's dive team leader was with us, but the detective would be with the family, and the dive team leader would walk over the family, give them the bad news that, you know, today was not, you know, we couldn't really interface with them too much. That's the local people's jurisdiction. But we were making progress, I felt like we were making progress each day. That is, we were cutting down on the area where we thought he might be. The area where we were searching was getting narrower and narrower and tighter each day.
But Bobby, let's talk for a second about the mental pressure. We promise our listeners that we're going to take them behind police lines so they understand what the cases that law enforcement professionals work do to them, how it impacts their emotions, your mental abilities, and your ability to do your job. So just sitting here, I feel sick because I can't imagine getting out of the water and looking that mother, that father in the eye and knowing one more day has passed. I haven't, through no fault of your own, obviously, but one more day has passed and we haven't found their son who's, you know, laying in a watery grave somewhere. I mean, the mental strain, how did you deal with that?
Well, that's one of the reasons I tried to keep a distance between the family and the divers, and at least until the thing is over. Unfortunately, a lot of times in these kind of cases, we're at the one local motel in the area that everybody stays at. And if the family has relatives that come in from out of town, they're going to be in the lobby. They're going to be at the breakfast in the hotel. And so you're going to hear them talking. They're going to know who you are, and they're going to be whispering and talking to you, or maybe trying to engage you in conversation. So I try to limit my divers' interaction with that, with the family and with the relatives, because I need them focused on what they're doing. And almost all of my divers had children of their own. So I need them to not really kind of get caught up in that, that we have a time and a place to deal with that. And usually it's after. The FBI has a fairly robust now, a critical incident stress debriefing program. So whenever we came back from a job where we actually recovered human remains, we would institute that program, and a trained professional would come to our warehouse, and every diver that was on that mission would sit for an hour with the counselor and talk about their experiences and things like that. And so that's how you do it. You compartmentalize it while you're doing the job, and you deal with it later.
It's not that you don't feel the stress. I mean, there's a little bit of that when you're a prosecutor, because as you're preparing the case and talking to people like you who are investigating the cases, when you have these serious, terrible child abuse or child murder or other kind of terrible cases, you try not to focus your emotions, but you are a human being and you do have those emotions. And so I think it's one of those things that I admire most about our law enforcement professionals is, in this country, they put those things aside and do their job. And it sounds like that's exactly what you did, is you did your job. So after 3 or 4 days, you feel like you have the underwater tree forest mapped. What happens then?
Yeah, so we then, when we were right in the area, we narrowly, and we focused it down, we saw what we thought was probably the boat, because man-made objects and natural objects look very different underwater, especially with a sonar. And you're dealing with shadows and shapes. Well, when you have a right angle, for example, on something, right angles don't occur in nature. It's usually jagged and unsmooth. So when you have a smooth surface or a right angle, something machine-made, somewhat, and this is an art form. You know, it's science that's giving you the image, but it's an art form in reading those images. So my guys that were very conversant in imaging and interpreting sonar images kind of found what they thought was the boat. We didn't see the child because the child was much smaller, but we knew if we could get to the boat, we could find the child. And so we found what we thought was the boat, and we marked it. It was kind of later in the day, and we want to start the next day.
So how deep into this lake was it?
I think we were between 85 and 90 feet deep.
Okay, so that's pretty deep, and you're under some pretty significant pressure
there. Sure. You have to, you know, you have to take decompression. You have to take that into account. There's only a certain amount of time you can spend at that depth before you have to come up.
And you have to come up slowly, right? You can't just come right up.
No, you have to come. Not only do you have to come up slowly, but there are points that you have to stop and actually wait a certain amount of time before you can proceed on ascending even further.
And that's because there's such air pressure down there that the air that you're breathing into your lungs as you come up would continuously expand, and it would just blow open your lungs, wouldn't it? And
well, that's
vessels.
That's one. Or the nitrogen that's forced out of liquid state into a gaseous state, the nitrogen would form bubbles in your bloodstream or your other tissue. And those bubbles would the same way. It's like a balloon. When you bring it up, it's going to expand too rapidly, and it's going to burst some tissue or blood vessel. If it bursts in your lungs, you know, you're going to have an embolism. If it, you know, depending on where it bursts, it could be really bad. It can kill you instantly. So by coming up slowly, those bubbles, instead of expanding greatly too quickly, they get absorbed back into the liquid. So that's just the, you know, the physical properties of gases and liquid. So if you come up slow enough, those nitrogen bubbles or those oxygen bubbles, they will go back into solution. And so that's at that level. So what we did was we went back that night. We hadn't had divers in the water for 3 days. And so I told the detective and the dive team leader that we had a target that we were going to dive on next morning.
Then there's still a lot of planning that has to be done, though, because you do have to plan how you're going to dive down, how long you're going to be able to be there, and how slowly you're going to come up.
So that's what we did that night. We spent the whole night planning the dive. I chose what 3 divers were going to do it. So because you have 2 divers go together and then the safety diver on standby, and he's dressed, they're all dressed out. So we came up with a plan, and the next morning we went about instituting the plan. And it was tough because they, you know, going straight down on a pleasure dive, you go straight down to the bottom. With this, they kept hitting branches at about, I would say, I don't know, from the surface, they probably got to about 40 feet without hitting anything. And about 40, between 40 and 50 feet, they started hitting the trees. So now you're at the treetop at 40 different.
Do you have communication with them the way you see in that movie, the one a long time ago, sort of revolutionized everything called The Abyss, where you can actually have active communication with the divers?
We're in full helmets, dive helmets, and those protect you from the branches and stuff, and they're, you know, hard hats. So, and they have full two-way communication. They can talk to each other. They can talk to us. We can hear them. We also have cameras on the helmets. In this case, it helped a little bit, but oftentimes the cameras don't give a lot of view because the visibility in the water is so minimal at a time. Yeah, we have lights and cameras on the hat.
So they go down, they get down to wherever they need to penetrate the forest, where you think the boat is, and what happens?
They basically, if you can imagine yourself climbing down a tree, is what they were doing. They were climbing down these tree trunks, and they were trying to break the branches as they went along. So it took them a while to get down from, say, 40 or 50 feet. Now they had another about 30 or 35 feet to break through these trees and get to this object. Now, remember, we don't know it's the boat. We think it's the boat because of the way it looks on the sonar. You know, we're not going to know it's the boat until we put people on there exactly, and they can tell us we're on a boat.
And at this point, they also have to worry about their lifeline could be caught in these upper tree branches and could get cut, could get, especially if they're breaking branches, could get snagged, and they might not be able to get out of there. So this has to be really, really tough on them.
Yeah, and each diver has a bottle, like a standard scuba bottle, on his back, which we call that a bailout bottle. So if something happens, if they have to get off our air supply from the surface, or if it gets cut, or if it gets kinked, or something like that, then they can turn a knob and they can start breathing off their bottle. But again, as I said earlier, you've got about 30 minutes of emergency, what we call emergency gas, to then solve whatever problem it is that's causing you to not be able to access your surface supply there.
Difficult, dangerous, mentally taxing. You're looking for the body of a three-year-old. What happens?
So they break through, and sure enough, the first diver, because one is above the other, he's tending him from above. And so the lead diver hits the boat and he says, yeah, I'm on a boat. Again, we think it's the boat, obviously. He says, it's a boat. And then he starts looking around, and there was some visibility down there. And in short order, he made his way around the boat. The boat was pointed down with the mast of the boat broken up. When he worked his way down the top of the boat, what would be the top of the boat, where the mast was and the sail, the child, he located the child within that sail material. And it was wrapped up, and he had to take a knife out, and he had to cut away some of the sail and some of the other rigging to free the child.
This is just horrific, Jim. I mean, can you imagine? I cannot imagine being that person. I really cannot. I just can't put myself there, because just sitting here, I'm horrified. I'm feeling very emotional about it. I can't imagine how that diver felt.
But at the same time, when he's doing that, I'm sure he had to also be cognizant of what exactly are the circumstances here, so he could determine whether or not this was an accident,
right?
Based on what you said earlier. So what did he do?
As he found the child in the sail and he was kind of trying to pull the stuff away from him, he saw where the child was caught up in some of the rigging, and he determined that the child was not tied to the boat. In fact, the child did get caught up in that rigging. There was no rope. There was no line other than the sail rigging. So the child did get caught up, and the father, as instructed and as he told the police, had not tied that child to the boat. And so the child was still in his life jacket, but he was caught up in the rigging, and the boat had gone down like a rocket and stuck in those trees. And so he unwrapped the child and he cradled the child, and then we started our ascent. They came up together, the two divers and the child, and at about, I would say about 20 feet, we stopped them for a safety stop. So while they would off gas, and at that point, we had them place the child into a body bag, into a covering, so that, you know, you could spare the family from the prying eyes of the media that might have long-range lenses and stuff that's taking pictures or something. That's the last thing you want. When they were done with their safety stop, about 5 minutes at 15 feet, we brought them and the child up to the surface. And then we brought them back on the boat and we started in.
So were you and your team present when the family was made aware that you had recovered the child's body?
We don't usually confirm that we have the child until the child or the victim is back on the boat with us. There's a lot of things that can happen before that. So once the child was back on the boat, now this area was within sight of the loading dock, the boat ramp and stuff. So, I mean, they saw us.
They could see the body bag come out of the water.
And I think that they might have, you know, I don't know how the detectives handled it, but I know that when we got the child back on the boat, I looked over and I could tell, because I had already radioed to the dive team leader, that we had the child, and he had told the detective, and that's when they made the notification. So as we were coming in, family already knew. They were distraught, as expected. It's one thing to know the child's gone. It's another to have it confirmed. And so as we were coming in, we always have the medical examiner's office there with us, or waiting at least. We turn the child over to the medical examiner. Whether or not they allow the family to view the body at that point or not, that's their business. You know, I probably would have advised against that at this time. The child was in the water for 3 or 4 days. So I think it would probably be better to get the medical examiner to get it, do whatever they have to do, and then get it to a funeral home for preparation so that the family can view it. That would have hopefully been my advice, because you don't want to see a body that's been in the water for 3 or 4 days.
I can't imagine how this could possibly be a best case for you, Bobby. How do you categorize this particular case?
You know, I like to say that whenever we found what we were looking for, whenever we're successful in recovering a victim, that's a success for us, and that's a good day. So that's a good case for us. But I always used to remind my divers that when the diver finally says, I've got it, I found it, I found her, I found him, you know, there's this kind of an exuberation on the boat that happens up top because we've worked really hard. But you don't want to make it look like a celebration. And you don't high-five each other on the boat, and you don't whoop and holler on the boat, even though there's this release that, yes, we did it. It's been hard work. It's been dangerous, but we did it. Because when we have a good day, someone else is going to have a really bad day.
Yeah.
And that's just our lot in life. That was our mission. And so when we have something to celebrate, that means someone else is going to have something to not celebrate and really have a hard time. So that was the line I always used. I said, when we have a good day, someone else is going to have a really bad day. Just remember that. There's a time and a place for us to pat each other on the back for a job well done. It's not the time at the boat, or it's not the time when we bring the victim back on board. Even though that's the time usually in everyone else's line of work when you do it, when you cross the finish line and when you do something like that, we always had to kind of suspend that and hold off and do that later. Not that it was inappropriate. We didn't do anything inappropriate. It's just when you do a job like that and there's a lot of adrenaline and there's a lot of danger, it's a release. There's a certain amount of release that comes with the job being successful.
Well, Bobby, I have to say, I do not know how you did that job. I have so much respect for you and for everyone on dive teams everywhere currently that are working these incredibly gruesome and difficult cases. I just want to say thank you. And I certainly hope, Jim, that this might be the first in a bit of a series of Bobby's dive team cases, because I think that there are a lot of lessons to be learned, and I suspect our listeners are going to be very interested in them.
I think you're right. And I really want to echo what Francie said. Thanks for doing what you do. It's difficult when your job is working in an environment where humans cannot survive. And so every single day that you go to work, your life is on the line in many more ways than the average law enforcement officer. So thank you for doing that. And thank you for making such a profession out of it, because I'm sure it's helped to solve a number of cases that would otherwise have gone completely unsolved forever.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. And till next time, signing off for Best Case, Worst Case. Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Mike Thal. Music composed and performed by Simba Sumba. And hosted by Wonder.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Knowledge is power, and when we know the facts about sexual abuse, we can better protect kids. Darkness to Light has already trained more than 1.4 million adults to keep children safe from sexual abuse.
I'm one of those 1.4 million, Jim. Using their Stewards of Children Prevention training, they give you and gave me the facts, tools, and tips I needed to help keep the kids I love safe, and you can do the same with their Stewards of Children Prevention training. Get trained today to prevent, recognize, and react responsibly to child abuse in your community.
Learn more about Darkness to Light and child sexual abuse prevention at www.d2l.org. That's D, the numeral 2, L.org.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.